to life. Open every day at 417 Southeast 11th on in Portland and at adxportland.com. And we have 1 minute to listen to a couple of announcements, and then we're going to go right to the Dirtbag with Glenn Andreessen. Thanks for tuning into KABU today.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Drink and Think Trivia, Saturday, April 15th at the Blackwater Bar in Portland. Drink and Think Trivia helps get books to those in need. This night is a benefit for the Children's Book Bank and Books to Prisoners. Again, that's Drink and Think Trivia Saturday, April 15th at 7 p.m. at the Blackwater Bar, 835 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Minors are allowed until 11 p.m. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Native Wisdom Film Festival on Saturday, April 15th, starting at 2 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in Portland. The Native Wisdom Films Festival features four recent films directed by Lawrence Johnson: The People of the Caribou, The People of the Oregon Coast, The People of the Well, and The People of the Oregon Interior. Accompanying the films is a selection of shorts made by students in the Wisdom's Native Film Academy. Again, that's the Native Wisdom Films Festival, Saturday, April 15th, starting at 2 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Whistle Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. Here we are after 2 months of vacation. Well, at least we were off last month, March. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. Jim, my regular co-pilot, is traveling hither and yon. Should be back next month, but in his stead, an equally capable, but on the other side of growing knowledge, is Chip Buble. Now, Chip, I need to apologize here. I'm not saying that you have no knowledge of fruit growing. But
it's more modest than Jim's.
But he does have a vast knowledge of vegetables, and that's what we're going to talk about here today in Jib's absence, because this is the season really where we ramp it up.
It should be. It should be, but yeah. The weather has not been perfect.
Well, usually I say we have, you know, maybe 2 months of winter and 4 months of spring or something like that. But
yeah, this has been exceptionally cold. We haven't had such a low amount of heat accumulation in our soils and in our growing conditions for a long time. We've had, prior to this year, three very, very good,
yes,
warming up in February and March. I mean, we've had very few days above 60 degrees. And that's incredible for getting to the middle of April. So anyway, that has a huge impact on vegetables, whether you're putting them out by transplants or whether you're trying to direct seed. It's very significant impact.
So we've got a full lineup of things to talk about. Chip, I should say, by way of introduction, is an OSU Extension horticulturalist.
That's correct.
Based in Columbia County.
That's correct.
Where you've been for
a
decades.
Long time.
You're right.
I've taken root.
Is retirement on the radar?
Oh, it would have to be at some point, yes.
Well, okay. Yeah. Well, that leaves more time and more guest spots on the dirt bag. I've tried to have you on here maybe a year ago or something like that, but you were just slammed whatever you your normal thing. What is an extension horticulturalist?
Well, you know, typical? And actually, my assignment is larger than that. In that county, I do the what we call home or community horticulture, which is everything from master gardener training to just answering questions, putting on programs for people in the county. But I also work with commercial growers of fresh market vegetables or field crops, and I actually even do some livestock work. So it's a varied portfolio.
I've mentioned before on the show, although it's been a couple of years, that the Columbia County Master Gardener newsletter is my favorite newsletter that I get. Yeah. I read the first two pages and then glance at the other. But Chip will have topical things there, new research that's found out, and even just practical advice that only a seasoned and experienced teacher would have, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
And then I go to the last couple of pages, and it's livestock stuff. So he's well knowledgeable, and we're fortunate to have many, or probably all of our extension people. I used to call them agents. I don't think they call them that anymore.
Well, I call myself that still.
Okay. He's old school.
But
well, at half past the hour, we've got a tough garden stumper. Well, we'll see. And we, of course, always welcome your questions. It doesn't have to be just related to vegetables. That's what we'll be talking about mostly. 503-231-8187. That will also be the number that you will call to answer the garden stumper in about 25 minutes or so. Well, we've alluded to probably the major driver this month anyway is the temperature and the just soggy soils. What would you guess is how far are we behind on average?
Well, in terms of the, and you can use, for example, the emergence of fruit tree flowers as sort of a gauge of even soil temperatures, because they're responding to the same ambient conditions. And we're 10 days to 2 weeks behind, I think, in floral emergence for many of the fruit crops. Apples are often fully in bloom by the middle of April, and that's this weekend, and I don't think we're going to see that.
I'm seeing a little pink right there,
but we are definitely behind and continue to be slower. There's a way of measuring heat units in a sense where you take the high and low temperatures every day, average that high and low temperature, and if you're looking at most vegetables, you subtract 50 degrees from it. So you get sort of a heat unit accumulation for each day, and you add them together, and that gives you some measure of how warm or cold it's been and how the plants are going to respond. And we are at the very bottom end of what it should be for this time of the year. That's not good. The other issue with all the rain is that you get in most of our soils that are fairly decently clay, they hold a lot of moisture, and unless I'm sure your garden has lots of organic matter in it, but many gardens don't.
Right.
And without that organic matter, you start to try to work it up, and you'll create sort of glazed edges on the clay that once they dry out, they become very hard and almost very difficult to work back in later. So one of the key things, I think, in gardening is not to work really wet soils too early.
Particularly if it hasn't been amended.
Right. And raised beds help, because raised beds improve the drainage. And so as that happens, then you take the moisture out some and you warm it up, because a raised bed without as much moisture in it will warm up faster than the same soil that's more water saturated at ground level. And so all those things work together. So raised beds, organic matter help improve the situation. I've known some people, when they're trying to direct seed, that they'll actually put clear plastic over the soil for a period of time. Mm-hmm. It acts like a mini greenhouse and can sometimes push temperatures from 42 to 62 in a relatively short period of time. And that can be good to either transplant into if you're putting in transplants, or in some cases if you're direct seeding into that warmer environment there. So
that's the technique that I use when I seed peas.
Oh yeah.
Although I use glass panes.
Sure, it's the same idea.
It gets me into trouble sometimes, but I just have the smaller panes from a six pane window or whatever.
Sure.
And
And you just put them over the row?
Yeah, after I seed it, and it warms the temperature in it, and it prevents compaction and
all of it.
Yes, somebody dig. Tammy says squirrels even digging in it, but it also prevents the soil from cooling when we get cold rains.
That's correct. Too.
So it's just it works out real well.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. I mean, it's amazing how much a 10 degree difference in soil temperature affects emergence. There's some, you know, I mean, if you take something like carrots. At about 50 degrees, it takes them 17 days to emerge. At near 60 degrees, it's 10 days. And at 68 degrees, it's 7 days. You know, that's a tremendous difference. And a lot of these seeds, the longer they stay in the ground, the more vulnerable they are to insect predation, slug predation, disease issues, all these kinds of things. So getting that plant out of the ground quickly is crucial. So anything you can do to warm the soil, raised beds, coverings over the plants to get the soil.
Yeah, I might try a little bit of that. Put my glass on after I seed carrots.
Yeah,
I haven't done so yet.
Yeah. They should come up faster.
Yeah,
you do have to watch out with the glass because it can actually if it's a really sunny day all of a sudden and you're not around, you're tending your bees or something like that. Then you can cook fast.
I used to use cold frames, but one day. Went to a friend's house and it was sunny and I didn't have it cracked or cracked enough and my work was just fried and that's when I put in a greenhouse maybe if it had some more control over that temperature. Okay, well, what should we you've talked about that difference between open, let's talk about between open pollinated, heirloom, hybrid, GMO, vegetable varieties here.
Okay. So I get a lot of questions about, are hybrids genetically modified? And for me, the term genetically modified refers to a particular technology where you're actually inserting a gene into something through a non-conventional breeding technique. Either you're transferring that gene with something called agrobacterium, or you're, there's ways to transfer it with something called a gene gun. There's several different ways to transform that thing. But most vegetables, very few vegetables that are available to the homeowner are genetically modified. And the reason for that is that it's kind of an expensive process. Every area has their own little varieties. And so it doesn't make market sense, really.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of reason for it in the vegetable world, particularly.
Can just the average home gardener buy a GMO veggie?
There aren't. The only two crops that I know of that might be in a vegetable garden that are genetically modified to some degree would be, you can buy some sweet corn varieties. Well, there are sweet corn varieties that can be planted. I don't believe many are planted in Oregon, and I know the major processors don't use them, but there are some sweet corn varieties that are genetically modified. And there is one weird squash virus that they've modified it in a way by adding the viral coat to create an immune response. And so there's one summer squash series that's been modified in that way specifically to resist the virus. But again, it's not available to the homeowner.
Okay.
And I don't think it's being sold in the stores particularly.
So. Okay, so we can just say.
So genetically modified is not there. So open pollinated is the way that most varieties were grown and kept and saved for the 10,000 years humans have been farming. And that basically means just getting a population of plants of a certain type, like a radish or a spinach or whatever, and every year collecting seed from a portion of that crop that you let go to seed, and being careful before you collect the seed, you've rogued out anything that looks to be off type or not what you want. And so you're developing a sort of a genetic base that's narrowed but still pretty predictable for your area, performs well in your area. So that's what farmers did for years and years. They just selected the best stuff every year, the ones that went through the disease, the ones that went through the the insect issues. Sometimes there's insect resistance, not always. Maybe the ones that could emerge in better cooler temperatures better, something like that. Anyway, they collected these variations and saved those for lots of years. And so that was the standard breeding technique up to about 1925 or 1930. And within that context, there's this concept of heirloom. And an heirloom really is a bit fuzzy.
Yes.
it's any seed that has sort of a fairly long culinary history. Any seed strain of whatever crop it is, beets or carrots.
So we could say that maybe all heirlooms are open pollinated.
That's correct. But not all open pollinated right. are heirlooms right. because there still are varieties being developed in that manner, you know, by mixing stuff together, doing crosses, selecting the desirable things that come out, back crossing them a little bit. And that's just standard breeding techniques.
So is that hybridization then?
Well, hybridization is a hybrid plant is actually one that's created by the combination of two distinct pure lines. And so one serves as the so-called male parent, in other words, provides the pollen. One serves as the so-called female parent, provides, you know, receives the pollen and produces the seed. So it's a kind of a complicated process because if it's something like corn, to get a hybrid with corn, you know, both the male, sort of the male parent and the female parent are going to produce pollen, and both the male parent and the female parent are going to produce corn. But what you don't want is the female parent to produce its own pollen, because you want it to be only pollinized by the so-called male line. So this is why they used to go through in the Midwest when they were producing, or anywhere where they were producing corn seed about 40 or 50 years ago, and they would detassel all the female plants.
Uh-huh.
So that they couldn't produce any pollen, that the only pollen was coming from the lines in the field that were so-called male plants, which they didn't care about the seed coming from those. They were only to provide the pollen. So anyway, it was a distinct crossing between, you know, the pollen comes from this line and the female genetics are the other side of it from this other line.
So but they would only be doing that if they were going to save, if they wanted the seed.
They wanted the seeds. And this is why when you take those plants, say you took a hybrid tomato plant or any of these hybrids that have been crossed from two distinct lines, you plant the resulting seed, and for the first year it'll be fine. But after that, it will start to wander in genetics. You can't recreate it necessarily because it was created by this distinct crossing process to start with.
So there's nothing sinister.
No,
it's still from a hybrid. I mean, from hybridization.
No.
I mean,
it's still a conventional breeding technique. Totally. The only thing you can't do, sort of directly, is recreate it. Save the seed yourself and recreate it directly, because you'd have to have the two lines to cross.
So Sungold, for example, do you know who the parents are of?
Is Sungold a hybrid? I'd have to think about
it. I think
that.
So.
Okay, so if Sungold's a hybrid, you'd have to know what the parents were.
Or do you know another tomato where you know
well,
the
parentage? I think, for example, Early Girl is a hybrid.
And was that developed at Oregon State?
No. Okay. Early Girl was not an OSU variety.
Okay.
Anyway, but I think there have been some people that have taken the Early Girl seed and then started their own efforts to return it to an open pollinated version that's pretty well Early Girl. So taking the best of it. But some of the reasons sometimes that you cross are actually not necessarily visible in what you're actually eating, because they may provide disease resistance or some kind of a different vigor characteristic or leaf canopy characteristic or something like that. So there are different reasons why you have the two parents. It's all about the fruit in the end, but it may differ in how that fruit gets there.
I know in some of my presentations, I have a parentage chart of the Marionberry.
Yes.
And
that's complicated.
Boy, there's grandparents and great grandparents and probably some uncles and things. It's just really interesting to see all the different things. I think there's even raspberry
In a lot of the blackberry types, the Boysens, the Logans, the Marions, there's a bit of raspberry in them. The more raspberry in the more complicated they are to grow in terms of root diseases, because raspberries are more root rot resistant. The less there is, the more hardy they are in our soil. So
to sum up this hybrid thing, there's you know, we have pure lines, mm-hmm. which might be pure lines of dogs, for example, but then we end up with a Sun Gold or a Labradoodle.
Yes, that would be about right.
People have been breeding, right. you know, for
like
years.
I said, so like I said, the only disadvantage is if a person really feels that they want to save their own seed, it's very hard to do with a hybrid to get it
right.
consistent without a lot of effort over time. You know, there are some seeds if you're getting any kind of plant that's not a hybrid plant. There are some vegetables that are seed saving is pretty easy. Tomatoes are self-pollinating basically, unless you go through some complicated steps to avoid that in making a hybrid. Green beans are self-pollinating. Peppers are mainly self-pollinating. They've got a little bit of wandering, but they're pretty much self-pollinating. Lettuce, amazingly enough, is pretty self-pollinating. And so those are gonna, if you're starting with a non-hybrid seed, you can save those seeds pretty much.
And before we leave this topic, mm-hmm. what are some that you'd want to stay away from?
Okay, well, squashes have a tremendously promiscuous history in terms of crossing. There's some, in terms of winter squashes, we have four different species, basically, of squashes with one genus. And so those things have some very complicated crossing relationships. And because you have male and female flowers on the same plant, and you have bumblebees doing the crossing, as well as honeybees, there's almost inevitably, whatever, if you're growing more than one winter squash, if you have a butternut squash, the butternut is, you know, seed that you plant is always going to be a butternut that year, but the seed inside that butternut squash is going to be a very complex genetic mix of whatever squashes you had growing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could be a cross between that and the zucchini. And
well, not necessarily a zucchini, but the winter squash. The
zucchinis hardly turn out to be zucchinis. You know, we get volunteers in the compost pile or in the ground and whatnot.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a break here. I'm talking with Chip Buble from Columbia County OSU Extension, the vegetable edition here. Because it's been so dreary, I don't have a theme for my tunes this time, just that they're upbeat, because that's what we should remain. Here's the Jazz Police. The Gordon Goodwin Fat Band. That's PHAT. Gordon Goodwin Fat Band. That's a good one. Jazz Police. It's from the album XXL. Okay, Chip Buble here beside me. And our plant of the month, and we'll spend a fair amount of time here talking about garlic and other alliums, in that, well, it's time to plant some alliums, and of course garlic has been planted, hopefully. You know, people ask me, you know, can I plant garlic now, or in January or February?
I mean, you can plant it and it'll grow, but it won't necessarily bulb normally, because bulbing in garlic is triggered by it reaching a certain length of day in terms of the sun-darkness pattern. And so if there's not many leaves out there, when it starts to try to bulb, you don't often get much, or you may not even get a bulb forming. So the later you go, kind of the middle of March to end of March is about as late as you can really go in most cases without, yeah.
So, and ideally then we'd be planting in the fall.
Yeah, people plant in the fall. There are places in the United States who do a spring planting of garlic because it's really cold in the winter, and they'll try to get it in if they can in March. That doesn't always work for them, and they may be dealing with, and I've never actually understood, because like Buffalo, New York, I think, grows a fair amount of garlic historically, and for just local consumption on the eastern seaboard, but they do, I think, mainly spring plant, and they get it in though as early as they can.
Okay, so it's too late to plant garlic now.
It's pretty much too late.
Yeah. Even though this has been a later year.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you just wanted to eat the
Yeah, you could eat the leaves. Grow it as green.
Right.
And you know, people are increasingly eating green garlic. It's quite popular in restaurants and things like that right now. So they're eating the leaves and the younger leaves especially.
Well, let's assume then that, like me, that we've planted the garlic in and it's doing well. It's up 10 or 12 inches now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What should we do?
Well, basically, garlic is sort of on autopilot at this point. The main thing is that keeping it weed-free is helpful to the garlic. It's not a super competitive plant, although once it's 10 or 12 inches tall, it's not bad in terms of competition. And usually fertilizing, and there are organic fertilizers, but something to provide some nitrogen a little bit this time of the year is a good idea. And the organic products take a little longer to become active and release the nitrogen in the soil, but that they would be appropriate to use right now. Beyond that, if the ground for some reason had gotten a little crusted, maybe very lightly with a rake or a hoe or something like that, break up that crust around the rows a little bit, wouldn't hurt. But other than that, and the other thing is keep the slugs off. Slugs do like garlic more than, you know, people are aware, and sometimes if the numbers build up high, they can actually do quite a bit of damage to the garlic.
Yeah, I don't know if my squirrels are eating those or not, too. They eat everything else, but jeez. All right, I'm not going to get into that, though.
No, I don't know if squirrels eat. I've never heard of squirrels eating slugs, but that would be a redeeming value.
No, I meant the garlic.
Or eating the garlic.
Yeah.
I don't know. Deer in our county, if you don't have a deer fence, will eat garlic.
You told me an interesting story before we went on the air about the pioneers and the gophers.
Yes.
Or early settlers. Anyway.
Yeah, so the French settlers in what we call French Prairie, which is out there by St. Paul, just kind of west of Woodburn there, St. Paul, Oregon, that area was replete with two forms of wild garlic and wild onion, two alliums. And the French settlers discovered, much to their surprise, that this animal called a gopher, which I don't think they have in Europe, would gorge itself on these alliums. And it turned out that the flesh quite appealed to these French settlers, and so gopher became part of the menu in that area during that period of time, like the, you know, 1830s to 1850s. So, yes.
Well, they were probably plentiful.
They were very plentiful, and they were agriculturally damaging, as they still are.
Yeah.
And so from their standpoint, they were both a food source and something to be gotten rid of. So that it was from their standpoint a virtuous circle,
but a win-win. If we happen to have a dry spell, would garlic need any supplemental water?
Typically not, especially if there's any moisture in the profile at all, because garlic has surprisingly deep root systems unless the soil is really compacted, and so the only time I would ever consider would be maybe one watering in late May if for some reason May itself was really, really dry. Mm. But beyond that, garlic usually goes through without any watering. By the time you get to mid-July, it's usually ready for harvest.
You mentioned, we haven't talked about that. What do we do leading up to harvesting of garlic? I mean, do we, I know, like onions, I cut off the water early, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I don't know about garlic.
Yeah, with garlic, there's really not much to do other than just sort of keeping the weeds at bay and keeping the surface of the soil, again, if you didn't mulch it or anything, keeping it, you know, loose enough that there's good air circulation around the plants. But beyond that, there's not much to do until we get to, with the hardneck varieties, they start to flower. And so the flowering response in the hardneck variety reduces the size of the bulb. And so if your ultimate goal is a good-sized garlic bulb, then you want to go in and just be clipping off those floral stalks as they're coming up. And those usually start mid to late May. And so that's when you start looking. And different varieties will be slightly offset in terms of the times they start to bloom. But anyway, these floral stalks are actually very good eating if they're pulled or just snapped off. You can just snap them off with your hand.
Oh, okay.
Okay, they're very, very good eating when they're young and tender. They're excellent eating.
So as soon as you see them.
Let them grow maybe 6 inches.
Well,
or eight
I mean,
inches.
Not for eating, but for maximizing
the bulb. Maximizing the bulb, yeah, as soon as
get
you
them
see
off, assume them.
Yeah.
Is that what we call scapes?
I mean, yeah, those are called scapes. Yeah, those are called scapes.
The flowering stalk.
Yep, the flowering stalk.
From the horticulturist, yep. Yes.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
And it's interesting, those flowering stalks open up and they start to produce rudimentary flowers, but those flowers don't last. They sort of abort spontaneously, and those little pea-like things that you can find in the flowers, they're called bulbils, are genetically identical to the garlic cloves below. So there are no crossing relationships in garlic. Garlic doesn't exist outside of human hands right now. The species that we know as garlic is completely a human cared for plant at this point in time. You can't go to Manchuria or wherever, I think Manchuria was where garlic was originally native, and you can't find this species anymore. Yeah.
So interesting.
It's in our hands.
Well,
for better or worse.
So I've had a problem with my garlic for the last couple of years. You know, I thought it was something in the soil, so I moved to new places and it had the same thing. And when I pull them up, they're just kind of rotting.
Yeah. From the root plate mainly, or from the base of the
plant? Yeah.
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 Okay. That's a disease called Fusarium basal plate rot. And it's a horrible disease because there's no, it does transmit in the clove. And it can transmit asymptomatically. And so Western Oregon is not the greatest place to grow garlic seed because of our really wet winters. So even though we've had commercial growing of garlic seed in the past, and we still do, you know, garlic seed meaning the clove stalk, to be shipped down to California to plant for planting out in California, it's not necessarily the best place west of the Cascades because of some of these soil-borne diseases or soil and clove-borne diseases. So it's a tough problem. What I would do would be, if you could find, I would just pick the best stock you can find, you know, the best bulbs you can find, and try to hope that they are not affected by it. And that would be one way to continue.
Well, they look good. I mean, they look good now.
They look good. No, that's the problem. But they can start falling apart. The other option would be, if you wanted to take a year longer, but it was one that was hardneck, you could actually take the bulbils from the top, plant those. You would be 2 years before you would get a garlic, but you wouldn't be carrying that disease with you.
So it's not in the soil.
Well, it's more in the clove stalk. Yeah.
Well, I start over with, you know, because I really don't have any to, you know, we eat some of them. But,
right.
But then I buy new stuff. So maybe the new stuff is, it'll be good this year.
Well, let's hope so. It's been a tough disease here in Western Oregon.
But those
and that and garlic rust has been really hard on some of our smaller fresh market vegetable farms.
What was it? Garlic rust.
Garlic rust.
And what's
and the symptoms there are sort of an orange speckling of the leaves, and it kind of just devastates the leaf area. And
mine,
it's a very, very
mine
small,
must have the fusarium.
I think that would be most likely.
Darn it! Because they're relatively easy to grow. I mean, culturally,
they are. They are. They're very straightforward. Yeah, garlic is very straightforward.
Yeah. Yep. So at least, you know, I figured, well, I don't have a lot invested in it, time-wise. But all right. So it does, let's see, onions. Let's get into our what is this we call the garden stumper here. Are you ready for that, Tammy? Nope. She's not there yet. She was all ready for my next tune, but I fooled her. Now she is. It's time for the garden stumper. Well, as I mentioned, I forgot my notes, but I can think of this one. What major U.S. city was named for the Native American term for the wild garlic that grew in the area? So, does Tammy have an idea? No. Oh, Tammy does think she has an idea. Okay, so we're looking for a major U.S. city that was named for from the Native American term for wild garlic variety. And, of course, I don't have that variety with me. I'm assuming it still grows. 503-231-8187. Okay, if you know the answer to that, or if you have a gardening question, same number. Okay, we have David's on the line. Do you have a question or an answer, David?
Hello?
Hello, David. You got a question or an answer for us?
Yeah. Okay, good. I wasn't sure you could hear me. Yeah, I have a garlic question. So I've been growing garlic in my backyard for a number of years, but recently I stopped using companion planting techniques for it and stopped planting it around apple trees. But it still seems to be doing fairly well. I was wondering, though, if you could explain how the companionship between garlic and apple trees works and what benefits I gain from it.
Okay, Chip, he's gonna
boy,
attempt this one
have,
because
I don't have an answer for that. So you planted these are sort of full size apple trees, and you're planting more or less directly underneath the apples. Is that right?
Or? Garlic.
Garlic directly underneath the apple trees.
What I've been doing was first off, the trees are they're actually 6-year trees right now.
Okay,
but. But what I've done in the past is plant the bulbs. My understanding from it was to plant the bulbs around the drip line.
Okay.
It's a companion planting technique.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. And I think, if I remember right, I think one of the benefits is controlling the disease and managing disease between the two plants, but I didn't know if you had any insight on that, so I thought I'd ask.
Well, I really don't, and I can't say that I've ever heard of that technique. Did that come out of some of the permaculture stuff, or I know
because
I think that they've planted some of the lily plants as part of an adjunct planting around fruit trees, but I'd not been aware of garlic. But so has the garlic been performing well for you though in that setting? I mean, you've been getting decent sized bulbs and everything.
Oh yeah, I get really good sized bulbs, good production out of it.
Okay.
I haven't seen any of the diseases that you've been talking about.
Okay.
I think I pulled that from the Rodale website, but I don't remember for
okay.
sure.
Okay. Well, I would say continue. I've got no reason to tell you not to do it because I don't.
All right.
It seems like if it's working for you, it seems like a good technique. I would think as the trees get bigger that the sunlight would start to limit maybe that technique. Although if you could continue to move out to the drip line, you'd be sort of at the edge of the sun and shade cast by the tree during the period of time when the tree's leafed out. Now the tree doesn't leaf out until, you know, right about now, or a little bit later. So you've got most of the growing time in the winter to get pretty full sun, especially after it emerges in January. You've got full sun up until now. So, yeah.
Right.
No, that's
right.
Really interesting. Is your soil pretty soft and everything around the drip line of the trees? Do you maintain kind of a garden setting all the way around the tree?
Yeah, I do. And
okay.
What I did was the garden that I'm working is still fairly new. So last year what I did was in the interest of just having something, you know, just having a space to grow, basically what I did was I ripped up the lawn in a specific area in my back lot and turned that into a vegetable garden.
Okay.
Along with fruit trees, and I grew corn, beans and squash around the fruit trees last year, and they did really well actually.
Mm-hmm.
But This year, I terraced off those areas around the fruit trees, and I'm having some soil delivered this weekend to kind of fill in the remaining level, and okay. kind of loosen up the soil a little bit more, because where I live in Springfield, about a mile from the Mackenzie River, and that entire mm-hmm. area is an ancient riverbed.
Right.
So you need a pickaxe to break up the soil right. because of all the river rock.
Well, the thing to do would be to plant some garlic there and then plant it someplace else and compare the results and then don't plant it around one of your apple trees and see what happens.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, no, good idea.
All right.
One other quick question. I have some second year raspberries going right now. Do you have any suggestions on controlling, I don't know, I guess what you want to call it, spread?
What was the plant?
Raspberries.
Oh, no, I don't have any idea on how to prevent raspberries from sending out runners. And
The only thing you can be doing is digging up the crowns and just trying to dig up the individual plants as you're going along. These are raspberries though that you want to keep the raspberries. You just don't want them to send up shoots into other areas.
Well I do, but only in certain directions.
You have to talk to that plant very carefully.
Right. Pull the ones that are out of line and leave the other ones there. Yeah. And wear gloves.
Right.
And they're pretty easy
to
snap off there. So
do you have any recommendations on the number of new shoots I should allow each season?
Well, the raspberries will typically fill in a row, and that's good, and usually you're selecting the most vigorous canes for the following year, the ones that have the largest caliper. Those are the ones that are going to bear the most. So, the ones that are smaller, maybe the ones that come up later in the season, you could take those out and just stay with the bigger ones.
I thin heavily, and I leave only two, maybe three shoots
in a clump
every 20 inches or so. But these are... I don't even know what the variety is anymore, so I've renamed them Glenn's Honey Raspberry. They're similar to Fall Gold, but they're a June bearer.
Oh, okay.
And large and sweet, but their canes can be 10 or 12 feet.
Oh, yeah.
So pretty vigorous.
Yes, very vigorous.
Yeah, I'm having really good success so far this year with my plants, despite all the rain.
Yeah, well, rain, water is good for most of the time.
And actually, soil that has a lot of rock and sandiness in it drains well, which is pretty not bad for raspberries because the root diseases that affect heavier soils are really going to be less present in your situation, so that's a good thing.
Thanks for calling, David.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Yep. Okay, let's go back to the phones here. Lee?
Chicago.
Chicago is right.
I learned it as rotting onion swamp.
Yeah, they call it, stinky, whatever.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Chicago, that's it.
So what do I win?
Just pat on the back, and you have to administer it yourself.
Do I get a question?
Sure.
I heard something recently about a fungus that's affecting apple trees.
Yes, go on.
and wondered...
A new fungus?
How severe it was and, whether it's something I need to worry about.
You mean like scab or something pretty common like that? Or
sounds
or something
like it's
new?
Killing the plants, killing the trees.
Hmm. I'm not aware of that. The most common diseases don't kill the trees. Apple scab doesn't kill a tree. There are a pair of diseases, European canker and apple anthracnose, that can create cankers on the trunks, not so much on the trunk, but on the limbs, to the point that they sort of girdle those limbs, and the tree can be really devitalized. It can be tough, and so I've seen some pretty bad examples of that in some locations. A little bit's an air circulation issue, I think, sometimes where there's a lot of moisture in the canopy, especially in the fall, because the disease, those particular diseases, the European canker and anthracnose, tend to spread in the fall more. But the way you see it, you'll see these sort of open, they look like open, kind of open wounds on
I see canker on prune and the native cherry.
Okay.
Where it's
oozing.
Yeah, it's oozing.
Right. Now that's a different disease. That's actually a bacterial disease called Pseudomonas canker, and that's a tough one. For it doesn't affect the pie cherries usually, but it does affect sweet cherries, prunes, peaches potentially, almost all the stone fruits except for pie cherries really. So that's a very difficult disease to manage as well. There's not an easy answer. I've known lots of people that planted peaches, and my advice has been in the years that I've been doing this, put it in the most highly air circulating place you've got. And then the other thing is make sure that you buy a peach leaf curl resistant variety, because even though that's a fungus and the bacterial canker is obviously a bacteria, I think the more vigor the tree has, maybe the more resistant potentially it is, and the leaf curl can make the tree less vigorous, and I think it may play at least some role in whether the tree survives a bacterial canker onslaught or not.
Well, what I was getting at is, does the canker on the apple look like the canker on the prune?
No, they're really quite different. There's no oozing or anything like that from the apple anthracnose. It's a very dry thing, and actually the area that is opened up, after a year you might start seeing some sort of woody tissue starting to grow over it a little bit. But still, it's really hard on the trees.
That's not new.
That's been around for a long time. You know, we have a really good OSU plant disease handbook that you can just type in PNW disease handbook plus Oregon State University, and it'll come up online, and it has amazing pictures and descriptions and cultural control techniques on all these kinds of diseases, so you can kind of read through what some of the options are and how to think about how to handle it in your own landscape.
Okay, well, thank you.
You bet. Good Bye. Job, Chicago. Okay, let's take our second musical break here, and we'll come back quickly. This is Pearl Harbor and the Explosions. Pearl Harbor and the Explosions. Okay, let's see. We got one call to take care of, and then we've got some various topics that we're going to sneak in here towards the end. Okay, David?
Hey, I heard you talking about squirrels, and that's my pressing question. Last year, I finally got some walnuts in my third-year walnut tree. Squirrels ate every single one. He ate most of my persimmons. And, you know, short of committing mass murder, I don't even know how I would do that. But I know someone in the neighborhood who poisons them. But, okay, we're not going there. But is there anything that can be done?
I don't know. I'll ask Chip because I only screen things and net things.
Right.
If I need to keep them off for sure. Yeah,
right. I mean, on a tree trunk, if they can't jump from tree to tree in the canopy, you can put up metal pieces that they can't climb.
Aluminum flashing,
you know,
three
aluminum
or 4 feet.
Flashing, yeah. Or something like that. That basically around the base of the trunk, if you can get it high enough that they can't jump it, and they can't climb from, you know, they can't go across a canopy in jump into the tree,
or from the power line,
from your house, or whatever. It's just so
tough in the city.
But if you've got the trees isolated enough that you can do that, that should work.
Yeah,
it does frustrate them too.
It'd be fun to watch. Well,
on the walnuts, it's a challenge because you usually wait till the walnuts drop.
Yeah.
And so they're going to be waiting with you, just like the Stellar's Jays wait to, they
well,
actually...
If they wait for the walnuts to drop, then at least I have a fighting chance.
Yeah. Get out there early.
Before they drop.
Well, what I thought, you know, if you had some type of netting that the walnut could fall through and you somehow were able to keep that, you know, 6 inches off the ground.
Right.
So the walnut falls through, but... So it's out of reach of the
squirrels.
Yeah.
Having things out of reach of squirrels is a complicated chore.
Yeah.
There's at least some way to go about it because, you know, compared to surrender, most of the people I know around here have basically chosen surrender.
Yeah. Well, we need more coyotes.
that does help in some landscapes.
I've got a few in the distant neighborhood, but yeah. I don't think they come around. I'm too close to the main street, but that gives me something to work on rather than, because I've surrendered just did not seem like what I wanted to do here.
Well, it's not sporting either. You know, you need to give yourself a chance.
I know, the one guy has a big walnut tree. He says, well, most of the years they leave me enough, you know, and then some years they don't, you know, they get almost, so, all right, that's a program to work on it. Okay, just that they only...
Okay.
They're climbers. Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You bet. Yeah, good luck, because, boy, you're going to need it. Okay. Jared. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Very well.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, I'm asking a question for a friend right now, so hopefully this doesn't make me look too bad. But
Yeah, right.
Anyways, he just got an avocado tree that's about 6 feet tall. That's a... I guess supposedly a hardy avocado, and 6 years old. He said that the person he got it from has never put any fruit off, and he's actually wondering if he can like cut the tree in like half, basically, and like graft in the avocado, like the top avocado branches into like a lower part of the avocado to make a smaller kind of. Bushier.
Well, it's too bad Jim's not here, but I don't think they sell avocados, and he wouldn't have any.
No, I mean, my guess is if you cut the stem, there'll be latent buds that will push out shoots. I don't think you need to be grafting anything unless you.
Yeah.
And the only point of grafting is to change the variety.
Okay.
So, I mean, if somebody were to cut a plant like that, it would put out some shoots.
Did he grow this? He or she? I guess you said
no. He just bought it.
From
he just bought it.
From
random person, I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
You know, well, these things aren't cold hardy here.
No.
So they have to be protected.
In and out, I guess. He, like, you know,
puts
it in the wintertime, and then I guess he can, like, put it out in the summertime, but he just wants to keep kind of a small, bushy avocado planted.
Yeah, no,
I don't know enough about, I don't know, no. I love avocados. I know nothing about growing them.
Yeah, because you know. We just don't grow them here.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks for trying.
Yeah. Another. He's going to need some good luck. Oh. Okay. Yeah. We'll talk to Amber. Good morning.
Hi, it's Amber. Am I on now?
Yep.
Okay. Good morning. I just wanted to make a suggestion. I use vinegar to get rid of some weeds. You can spray it on them or pour them on it around through your sidewalks and stuff like that. And I was just wondering if that would be something that would be useful on the edges of the raspberry line, you know?
Well, I've experimented with just off-the-shelf vinegar.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty effective against annual weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And the experiment that I did was not only that, but on some dandelions. And mm-hmm. boy, within a couple hours, it was, you know, it was just dark, you know. And in five yeah. days, it was just crispy almost. And in yeah. 13 days there, the new rosette was coming up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's tough on perennials. And raspberries are, you know, you can get good top, you'll still get good top kill, but it's not going to kill the
right,
plant.
Because it's got a good root system.
Sure does, there, right. yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, any plant that has a huge root system and a root reserve is going to be much harder to kill with something like right. vinegar or boiling water or some of those.
Yeah, the top
price
kill.
Of the gallons has gone up lately, just like everything else.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I you know, it's really not that hard to pull them. Or just uh-huh. snap them when they're young. They're very tender, but wear gloves because they do have the little tiny
right.
stickers on them.
Right, but that this was for the other guy. But here's what I have. Last year I bought a raspberry plant that says grows in the pot all the time. So it did okay, but now springtime I cut off the old growth from last year and because the new ones are coming up already and. But the pot seems to be real pot-bound now. So what do you think of that? Have you got any experience or knowledge?
Well, let me...
So-called potted ones?
But what you said there, and Chip, let me get your take on this, is that mm-hmm. if she cut off last year's growth, so to speak, and the new growth is coming out, did she cut off last year's growth that is going to produce this year? That's the typical...
Oh, so I... I screwed it up.
Well, possibly.
Well, uh-huh. so it depends. So did it bear? Has it borne raspberries for you once?
Oh yeah, there was a few raspberries on there last year.
And what time of the year were they there?
I don't know.
Were they there kind of late summer? Like August, September, or?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so you may have an everbearing type, and they're different than the standard July bearing types because they'll produce a cane and they'll bear in the fall. Then the tip of that cane will die, and so that won't do anything. But then lower down, you will get, you may get some fruit, although usually it may not be as good a quality mm-hmm. as the stuff that's produced in the fall.
Yeah.
So it could be if it's an everbearer or will bear in the fall, what you've got coming up right now will give you a good crop this August, September.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you may have cut off the possible spring crop.
Right.
Right. Oh, I see. Okay.
If it's an everbearing variety.
Right. Uh-huh.
Right.
If it's not, then
right.
you're sunk until next year.
Yeah. Well, I can handle it.
Okay.
Well, what about repotting it? What if it's getting too tight and it's in its pot?
Probably.
Yeah, if you felt, you know, you could. Is the pot just on a deck or something, or is it on ground? Or
it's on the ground.
Okay, well, it may be rooting through the pot.
I'm not going to let it do that.
So you see if
no,
you can rock it.
I live in an apartment. I have a small garden to the side of the building.
Okay, well, so periodically repotting is probably not a bad thing.
Or here's what I might suggest is to just divide it and then pot up and cut it in two and pot up one and then put the new soil around each.
Mm-hmm. Each half.
Yeah, you could probably even quadruple it if you wanted to.
Yep.
Okay, it sounds exciting. Okay, I hope it survives. I paid more for it than I normally do, petunias and stuff.
Okay.
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 Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, got one more call here. Tim.
Hello?
Hello, Tim. You're on the air.
Okay, cool. Hey, I got a question for you. I have a goji berry plant. I've had it for about 5 years. Took about 2 years, but after that, it started producing really well, lots and lots of berries. Then all of a sudden, last year, it dried up and died. The whole thing is just like a dead husk. And I went out this morning to look at it, and I couldn't find any growth or anything. I was wondering, is there anything I can do to salvage that thing, or should I just pull it out? Plant something new there.
Okay, well, so you're looking for new shoots, which is a good thing. So when did you actually see it die? When did you see that it was dead, or what you viewed it
fall.
As dead? Last fall. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds dead.
Yeah.
Well, take your thumb for just you know in the field, just scratch some of the stems
you know,
right,
and see, just see if there's green. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't see right. Not very well, so I used my hands to feel, mm-hmm. and I couldn't feel anything coming up around the base. I
I pulled some of the branches through my fingers to see if I could detect any buds or leaf or anything. I couldn't find.
Well, it's been awfully cold, though, so far. So things are behind in terms of coming out this year, too. So I would not give up on the plant yet.
Another way to check maybe to just try to break a branch. If it's dead, it probably will snap.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of them do snap. But
that's old growth.
A few that are snap resistant.
Okay, well they, I would...
Don't give up.
Don't give up. Right.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, I want to just... But we're out of time, Chip.
We'll have to catch up another time.
Chip was going to talk about some experiments that OSU Extension folks are doing on dry vegetable gardening.
A 20-second talk, and that is that there's farmers that don't have water rights or not enough water rights, and they want to grow some vegetables dry. We're experimenting with tomatoes, winter squashes, summer squashes, those kinds of things, growing them completely without irrigation here in Western Oregon in the middle of a summer that gets no rain. We're having some interesting results, and go online to look at dry vegetable farming plus Oregon State University, and you'll get Amy Garrett is the main researcher, but we're down in Corvallis, but we've got another one somewhere up here at North Willamette.
Well, Chip, we needed 2 hours today, but we don't have that. Chip Ubel from Columbia County, OSU Extension horticulturalist and agent.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Tammy, thank you very much. This is Glenn Andreessen. I'll be back next second Wednesday of the month in May. How about that? The very, very month of May, the very merry month of May, let's hope. Thanks for listening. That's my story so far.